There was a time in the mid-1960s when Fenway Park was this close to becoming a lost ballpark. That and the story of the 1967 impossible dream Boston Red Sox on this episode of the Lost Ballparks Podcast.
The Lost Ballparks Podcast is on the air.
Hello, everybody. This is Jack Buck with Carl Erskine at Municipal Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri.
From sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Brought to you direct from Comiskey Park.
So we have action at Ebbets Field, Brooklyn. And there's always action here.
Across the field in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
Sunny day here at Tiger Stadium. The wind blowing straight in from right field.
Well, friends, here we are back at the Polo Grounds in New York City.
So pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold shave or two throughout the evening.
Hi, I'm Mike Kozer, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 5 of the Lost Ballparks Podcast. Today's guest played 13 years with the Boston Red Sox, hit 210 home runs, including a league record for shortstops, 40 in one season in 1969, making him one of the great slugging middle infielders in baseball history. He was a two-time All-Star who played in two World Series, 1967 and 1975, and is a member of the Boston Red Sox Hall of Fame.
Rico Petrocelli leads off for the Red Sox in the second. His average is .309, and Rico's had 23 home runs, 49 runs batted in, and we're proud to say got more votes than any other player for the American League All-Star team. Drives one to left field, and we are tied way up in there for a home run. Petrocelli's 24th home run of the year, out of there in no time.
Rico Petrocelli.
Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
All right, good. Good to be on with you.
Hey, I really appreciate you doing this.
Bring back some memories.
You grew up in Brooklyn. Do you remember when and where you saw your first Major League Baseball game?
Yeah, I do. It's the old Yankee Stadium. But I had four brothers, two sisters, and they're all Yankee fans. So my brother, the one closest in age, loved the Yankees. So he would take me to Yankee games. I think the first one I went to, I was 5 years old. And I was in awe. I remember going in and looking up at this gigantic stadium, three tiers, that green grass, and the players out there taking batting practice and shagging and all. And I said, this is fabulous. I said that I want to be a ball player.
Yeah, you got to remember, back in the day, you listened to baseball games on the radio. If you were lucky, you had a black and white TV. But the first time you actually got to go see a game in person, that color of the scoreboard and the advertisements and the players' uniforms, it just exploded.
Absolutely. That's exactly what happened. I mean, I could never forget that. The look, my mouth was open. My brother says, what do you think? You like it? This is beautiful.
Oh, man, I bet it was. Especially going there for the first time as a kid. What about Ebbets Field? Did you make it there?
I did. In fact, I couldn't say too much about it family-wise because my family were all Yankee fans, but I loved going to Ebbets Field. The first game I went to, Jackie Robinson was playing, and it was so exciting, but it was so different. Yeah, the green grass and all the colors of the seats and all of that stuff was great, but this was a smaller ballpark, similar to Fenway, and it seems like you were right on, you know, on the field. And I said, this is cool. As I was getting older with friends, we used to go into Ebbets Field, and they knew us there. So they would kind of let us in, you know, up in the bleachers. But every seat was great because it was such a small ballpark.
Yeah. And of course, you had in right field the iconic Schaefer Beer scoreboard where the H would light up for a hit and the E would light up for an error. The Abe Stark suit sign, where if a player hit the sign, he'd win a suit.
Yeah, exactly. The players living in, growing up in Brooklyn, these were the Brooklyn Dodgers. So I felt comfortable rooting for them. And I had to root for the Yankees in the American League. So that was my out. Okay, I'll root for the Yankees in the American League, but the Dodgers in the National League. And
right.
So this way I wouldn't get beat up
by your brothers.
My brother.
Now, when you were growing up, like many kids too, you collected baseball cards. In fact, I think you had a Mickey Mantle rookie card, right?
I had it. Mickey was my idol. I actually got a 52 Mickey Mantle card. And
wow.
I mean, this was great. However, like an idiot with the other kids, you know, we used to throw them up against the wall, put them in the spikes of the bike. Everybody was doing that. And who knew? Really no industry at the time, card collectible industry. You know, we didn't know. So the thing was all marked up and all that. So I had this, like a lot of people, had the shoebox with my cards in them. All these cards, which I wish I had now, of course.
Yeah.
And we moved. And what do you think happened?
They got lost.
They threw them out. They threw them out with, you know, getting rid of all the junk. Oh, man alive.
Yeah. And a Mickey Mantle rookie recently, I think, in the last few years, sold for $2.8
million. Yes. And my knees knock every time I think about it. Yeah. Even though mine was marked up a little bit, it still would have been worth a lot, I'm sure. But mom, what'd you do? Where's the box? What box?
Oh, I threw that junk out a long time ago.
Exactly.
So you arrive in Boston at 20 years old. You got called up to the big leagues in September of 1963. Let's talk about the moment you walk on the field at Fenway Park for the first time.
I remember that as if it was yesterday. Johnny Pesky was the manager, and I had traveled with the team on the road. They wanted to show the prospects, you know, what it was like traveling in the major leagues on the bus, the airplane, and so on. And Pesky says, you're probably not going to play, but just work out, take ground balls, take batting practice, which wasn't easy in those days because the veterans, even the guys that were not regulars, they wanted a time in that batting cage. So they kind of gave you a hard time. But I'll never forget it. Johnny Pesky comes to me and says, you know what? I'm going to put you in there. One game, you'll really feel Fenway, you know, and just get in the game, get in the action. I said, yeah, okay. I was, you know, nervous as anything. I get in there. I'm at shortstop. I think I got a ground ball, and I caught it and threw the runner out. Then coming to bat the first time, not sure if it was Lee Stang, either struck out or grounded out. Now, the second time, Lee's in there. Lee has got an excellent curveball and not real fast. You know, he's got probably 85 mile an hour fastball. So he throws me this big curveball and it hung. And man, I hit it towards left field on the fly and I ran running towards first base. And the first base coach is saying, go, go, go. And I rounded first base, chugging into second base, slide into the bag, a pop-up slide. And I'm looking around like I'm in another world. And I don't know how many, like 2,000, 3,000 people there were standing up, you know, cheering me. I said, what happened? And they're saying, stay on the base, stay in the base. Oh, man, what a thrill that was. I got the ball.
Your first major league hit.
I still have it. It was thrilling. But it didn't end there. Now, I'm in the field, Minnesota that year, 65, all the way to 67. They killed us. 65, my first full year, they beat us 17 out of 18 times. They were tough. So I think it was Killebrew and either Big Frank Howard, they were fighting for the home run title. A couple of men on Minnesota. Here comes a ground ball to me. Double play. Beautiful, you know.
Tailor-made double play.
Tailor-made, except that the tailor was out that day, and I booted the ball. And who's up next? Mr. Killebrew.
Well, here's the Brew again. Harmon Killebrew.
And I tell you, I never saw a ball go so far and so high in my life. He hit one over the light towers in Fenway.
Well, stroke to left field, and this one is going to be gone. Harmon Killebrew has hit a home run.
Oh, my gosh.
I wanted to cry. Goes on and wins the home run title, but it was really an interesting day. I mean, naturally, I got the hit. I felt bad about the error. But I got a little taste of the big leagues and had to go back to the minor leagues. But it was a great experience.
The 1967 season, the impossible dream Boston Red Sox. Going into that season, the odds of the Red Sox winning the pennant, I think, were 100-1. Boston hadn't had a winning season in 8 years. In 65, the Red Sox finished with 100 losses. In fact, 1965, nobody cared about the ball club. A lot of players lived in an apartment complex in Peabody, and nobody would ask for autographs. Nobody bothered. They wouldn't come up to you in restaurants or on the street. And the crowds at the ballpark at Fenway, they were non-existent. There was a game that year against the Angels where the paid attendance was 409.
Yeah. We had more vendors than we had fans in the ballpark.
Yeah. And in 1966, it wasn't any better. The Red Sox finished ninth, 26 games out of first place. Now, that sets the stage going into the 1967 season, which was really a turning point in Boston Red Sox history. Owner Tom Yawkey was threatening to tear down then 55-year-old Fenway Park and have a new ballpark built, or he was going to move the team.
Yes, exactly. Either move it to the suburbs, which, of course, the legislature in Boston wasn't too happy about that, or move it out of Massachusetts. We didn't hear about that until after the 67 season. But second half of the 66 season, we started playing a little bit better, but, you know, we weren't going anywhere.
The average age of the Red Sox lineup in 67 was roughly 23. But manager Dick Williams was brought in to bring this collection of young guys up to speed quickly. And one of the unconventional ways he did that in spring training, in order to improve the pitcher's conditioning, was to have them play volleyball. So when Ted Williams shows up in Winter Haven, Florida, to work with the hitters and sees the pitchers playing a game of volleyball, what did he say?
Oh, you went nuts. He went, what the hell's going on here? Holy jeez. And you could hear him for 5 miles. And of course, Dick Williams being Dick Williams said, that's my decision. I feel it's going to help the pitchers. And Williams says, well, I don't want to say it. I want to hear what he said. And he left. He left.
Did he really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was mad. I mean, you know, Ted Williams, Red Sox, it's like he's the man. So, you know, there were a few people that were PO'd at Dick Williams, but he was the guy. They let him go. Dick O'Connell, the general manager, brought him in. And that was the big reason why we knew we were going to improve, not knowing we would, you know, actually win the pennant, because Dick brought a Dodger mentality in those days. Their organization were very
fundamentally sound, right?
Fundamentally, sound, because they taught it throughout the minor leagues and they stressed it so much that it became a part of your soul. So he brought that and he said, look, we're not going to worry about home runs. We're going to fundamentally sound. We're going to work on it in spring training. We're going to bunt. We're going to hit and run. We're not going to worry about the home runs will take care of themselves. We don't want to give away runs. He was serious. And of course, we all said, yeah, oh, yeah, great, great. You know, in spring training, of course, we started. Funny, because Tony Conigliaro was in right field and he got a fly ball with a man on third base and he threw it the 15th row over the home plate. And just the cutoff man for the guy on first, and he came in the dugout. Did he ream him out? What the hell are we working on here? So what are you doing? Hit the cutoff man. But we really improved. We really improved on it. Even Yaz said, hey, you want me to bunt? I'll bunt. Whatever you want to do. We're tired of losing.
And Dick Williams wasn't having any of it. And in fact, in spring training, he makes a bold prediction.
I honestly think we'll win more ballgames than we lose.
And he felt confident.
3 games into the 1967 season, the Red Sox are playing the Yankees at Yankee Stadium, and a young kid named Billy Rohr is pitching a no-hitter for the Red Sox.
Billy Rohr on the threshold with a tremendous performance today. 8 hits in the game. All of them belong to Boston.
It's the 9th inning, and this young kid is so close to throwing a no-hitter when Carl Yastrzemski makes one of the greatest catches you'll ever see.
Rohr winds. Here it comes. Fly ball to deep left. Yastrzemski is going hard. Way back, way back. And he dives and makes a tremendous catch. One of the greatest catches we've ever seen by Yastrzemski in left field.
Yes, yes. I mean, he's back to home plate. And he ran not the couple of feet to catch, but he ran a good, I don't know, 15, 20 feet. He just kept going, dove, and caught it. Wow.
Elston Howard ended up getting a little duck snort out to shallow right, but Billy threw a one-hitter against the Yankees in Yankee Stadium, and that was a sign of things to come that year. This was a different team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that helped our confidence, playing the Yankees in Yankee Stadium. You know, even though they didn't, many of them retired, Kubek, Richardson, and many of them, but they were still the Yankees, and it was still the old Yankee Stadium. It was nothing like it. It was incredible to just to play there, be on the field. We're all young kids. Whoa, jumping around. Whoa, Yankee Stadium. Meanwhile, we're beating the Yankees.
Yeah, I can't imagine, especially for a kid who grew up going to games at Yankee Stadium. And now, just a decade or so later, you're playing there. All right, so at some point of the year in 67, and I can't remember exactly what month, but White Sox manager Eddie Stanky was quoted as saying, Yaz is an all-star from the neck down. Whoa.
Yeah, he thought it would affect Yaz in a negative way. You know, he would try too hard and all of this. And, you know, Stanky, when he managed the White Sox, he used to freeze the balls before teams would come in. You couldn't hit the ball out with a bazooka. That thing was just frozen. I don't mean there was ice on there, but you can imagine.
Oh my gosh.
I said, what the hell's going on here? Yaz was hitting home runs with that ball. I mean,
so even with those.
Yeah, frozen ball. Yeah, he's still hitting home runs.
Unbelievable. And, you know, talk about waking a sleeping giant, because Carl Yastrzemski goes on to have a career year. Okay, June 21st, 1967, Yankee Stadium. After hitting a home run the night before, Red Sox third baseman Joe Foy comes to the plate to face Yankee pitcher Thad Tillotson. Tillotson throws a ball that hits Joe Foy right smack dab in the middle of his helmet. A horrific shot to the head, and Foy drops immediately.
Yeah.
Boston pitcher Jim Lonborg naturally retaliates and hits Tillotson when he comes up in the order.
Tillotson will go to first, and he and Lonborg are exchanging words now.
And the bench is clear.
And it's getting hot. There goes Pepitone as they go to it here at Yankee Stadium.
And you and Joe Pepitone, I think you guys went to rival high schools.
What happened when I got so mad was that somebody behind Joe, I know who it is, I won't mention his name, he's yelling at Lomborg saying that you could have ruined Tillotson's career.
And which ridiculous because he got hit in the back.
He got hit in the back, and Foy got hit off the head.
Right, off the top of his helmet.
He was nailed, and the ball went all the way up on the screen behind the home plate.
Right.
And I'm saying, what? Here we go, you know.
So it's like this huge dog pile.
I'm at the bottom. Pepitone's at the bottom.
And they're trying to restore order. That is Petrocelli that you saw there in that close-up shot.
Here comes my brother who was...
He was like a security guard at Yankee Stadium. Security guard, right?
Exactly. And they always put him by the dugout when we came in. But this time he comes out. Where's my brother, Pepitone? Where's my brother? And you hear a voice... Pepe says, I didn't do anything to your brother.
But listen, Rico, what's great about that brawl, though, is that it was just another reminder that this is a different team and that you guys had each other's backs. And you had a pitcher in Lonborg who was going to protect his hitters.
Yes, and we were going to protect Lonborg. He was the ace. He was the guy that really, pitching-wise, led us to the World Series. And you definitely want to protect them. Like a catcher, when somebody gets hit and the batter wants to go out there, the catcher usually is the first guy to grab him, you know, protect his pitcher. And this time, we were out towards right field. But I got so angry, that really just got me so PO'd that I charged. And fortunately, nobody got hurt, seriously hurt. Yeah, we were a team. We were a team who stuck together.
Midway through the year, Red Sox legend Ted Williams, who may have been skeptical in spring training, now fully believed in the team.
I would have to say that they've surprised a little bit, but from here on out, it ain't going to be no surprise to me because, I mean, I don't see anybody any better. I think that's the way they should feel.
Yeah. Guys like Reggie Smith, who is just a great talent. Tony, before he got beaned, and of course, Yaz is having a great year. Hitting home runs, knocking runs in and all that. And we had a pretty good closer, John Wyatt, got from Kansas City. John did a great job for us. And good defense. George Scott at first base. Forget it. I mean, he was one of the best.
Yeah, and Yaz, who goes on to win the Triple Crown that year, in addition to being a great player, a great teammate, I think he was instrumental in keeping the clubhouse loose. A lot of people may not realize that Yaz was a prankster. He would crawl under the seats of the team bus and give players... A hot foot? Okay, I think I have a pretty good idea of what this is, but what is a hot foot?
Well, you stick one of the matches, the stem, put it in on the side of the heel.
Of
you know,
shoe?
That little space. Yeah,
oh,
of
yeah.
the shoe.
Yeah.
And then light it. Now it would burn all the way down. He gave me one too. I mean, that hurts. That thing hurts. And yes, they're swearing, whoever it was that he got. And here he is in this. He always wore this Columbo raincoat. I mean, it was exactly like it. And yes, get the hell out. The guys would say, go buy a new jacket, a new coat, will you? And he was great. He was just a great, great teammate. And he'd have some fun. And he, in the clubhouse, he would say, okay, boys, let's go for the next game. And just had a great year.
Now, 1967, in addition to being a turnaround year for the Red Sox, it was also an unforgettable year for you and your wife, Elsie, who gave birth to twin boys, right in the middle of the season.
Yeah, yep. I think we were in Detroit. I called her and she's, "How you feeling?" Of course, yeah, twins, Jimmy and Billy. And I had Michael, the oldest one, and then eventually we had Danny, four sons. That was, of course, a thrill for me. Wow.
I mean, here you are in the middle of the year trying to focus on turning the Red Sox fortunes around, and your wife, Elsie, has got a difficult job, too. She's got twin boys that she's got to take care of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the wives don't get enough credit. The guys are on the road. All you're thinking about was playing the game, which you have to do and all that stuff. And the girls are back, taking care of the kids. They get them ready for school. It's obviously not easy. We had four in diapers, actually, at one time. They were close. Wow. Yeah, the wives were great.
On June 27th, your 24th birthday, you got word that you had been elected to the American League All-Star team as the starting shortstop. Your first appearance in the Midsummer Classic.
There they go. The American League All-Stars take the field. And the huge capacity crowd comes alive.
The 1967 All-Star Game was played in Anaheim.
The crowd in Anaheim's beautiful new $24 million stadium, completed only last year, is in a gay holiday mood.
I mean, I can't imagine. You're on the same team as Mickey Mantle. You and your brother Vince used to take the 40-minute subway ride from Brooklyn to Yankee Stadium to watch him play, and now you're on the same team.
Well, it was a thrill. I mean, I said to myself, what am I doing here? I mean, I know I was having a good year. But, geez, to be with Mantle and Killebrew and, you know, all those great players. And then on the other side, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Rose and all. I mean, it was just what a thrill it was. But with Mantle, I had got hit in the wrist a couple of weeks before, was all bandaged up. And so I got one at bat and I popped up against Marichal, I think. Went into the clubhouse and maybe three or four innings later, here comes Mickey. Mickey Mantle. I'm right there. Hey, Rick, how you doing? Wow, what a thrill. I mean, so he goes into the trainer's room and they're wrapping him up like a mummy. No exaggeration. That leg all the way up to his waist, almost to his chest. So he goes in, he dresses, gets a bat or something, goes out there to the dugout because I was sneaking, you know, to see what was going to happen. So I was in the runway. Manager says, Mickey, why don't you go up and hit?
Bauer sends Mickey Mantle to the plate as a pinch hitter, and the crowd gives the great Yankee star a standing ovation.
He gets up there, strike one, swings, you know, strike two, strike three, strikes out.
Mickey is caught looking at it for a third strike. It just got the outside corner of the plate.
He comes back in. I run back in. Here he comes, right? Goes to the trainer's room, unwraps. Takes a shower, dresses, and he's gone. Wow. I said, boy, to be a superstar, this must be fabulous. Oh, geez. Mickey Mantle, because he was hurting. I mean, he was.
Oh, yeah. This is near the end of his career.
Yes, yes. That's right. Next year was his last year.
Oh, and by the way, almost 15 months after that All-Star game, you would have the distinction of recording Mickey Mantle's final out.
Mantle pops to the shortstop, makes the catch.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, we didn't know. He didn't make it public till spring training of 69. And so I caught the ball. And what we used to do, you know, after three outs is throw the ball on the mound or near the mound for the pitcher, you know.
Right.
Didn't change balls like they do now.
Yeah.
And so when I found out that he was retired, I caught the last ball. I mean, I was, again, like the card, the baseball card. I was sick. If I had that ball now.
Yeah. I had it in my hands.
You know, it would be worth probably well over a million.
Oh, for sure.
Well over a million. So it was really special.
Rico, I want to take a second and talk about Tony C. Tony Conigliaro. For people who grew up outside of Boston, you may not realize this, but Tony C was probably as loved as Ted Williams in Red Sox Nation. Local kid, youngest player ever in AL history to reach 100 home runs. The beginning of his career was storybook. His very first at bat at Fenway Park, he hit a home run.
There's a drive by Conigliaro, and it is out of here. What a bomb he is. Conigliaro hits a home run, his first time at bat at Fenway Park.
By all accounts in 1967, he was on track to one day be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But as great as his talent was, and that's undeniable, he did have trouble avoiding inside pitches. Five times in his career, he had bones broken by pitches. And then, On August 18, 1967, the Angels are in town at Fenway Park, fourth inning. You're on deck, and Tony Conigliaro is at the plate. What do you remember about what happened next, Rico?
Well, where I was, I could see kind of a side view. I could see that ball when it was left the pitcher's hand. It was the height of his head. Next thing I know, there's a sound, bang, right under the eye, that bone under the eye, and his jaw was broken and everything. But I ran there. I thought it hit him directly in the eye, which could have lost his eyesight, and it's over, of course. Yeah. When I went there, I loosened his belt. I didn't know what, you know, give him air. The umpire was there, and actually the catcher, he looked down, and then he moved away. His cheek swelled up like a balloon. Holy cow. By that time, our team doctor came in, a trainer, brought him into the clubhouse and then back into the hospital.
A year later, Tony Conigliaro was talking with Howard Cosell and reliving what happened that night in 1967 at Fenway Park.
It was a strange night because just before I get up to bat, a smoke bomb was thrown on the field. And usually when a pitch is thrown inside, I'm able to get pretty much out of the way. And possibly by jerking my head, the ball will go under my chin. But in this case, the ball chased me. It came at my chin. And as I snapped my head back, my helmet flew off. And the ball hit me directly in the temple. And I remember getting hit with the ball, and I never passed out. And I kind of wish I did, because I fell to the ground, and my eyes and my face puffed up. I had my hands over my face. I could barely breathe, and I heard a loud ringing sound. And I thought that chances were I wouldn't make it. And I asked God to keep me alive at that point, because I knew I was in rough shape.
It's crazy when you think about it. The doctor said that if the ball had hit him an inch higher and to the right, that he could have been killed.
That's right.
He wasn't even 23 years old yet. Fractured cheekbone, dislocated jaw, and detached retina. And now, Rico, now you've got to stand at the plate and face that same pitcher. And I love this. You hit a 420-foot triple into center, bring home the first run of the game. The Red Sox go on to win 3-2.
Yeah, well, I was mad. I got in the batter's box, and they kept the pitcher in. I knew that after hitting a player, he was going to try to keep the ball away, and he was no way he was going to hit somebody else. So I said, I'm going to go up the middle, the right center field, and I caught it flush. I just kept running and running and running, and then slid into third base. I almost wanted to charge the mound, but you know, I was thinking of Tony and his family, his mom and dad, you know, his brothers. We were close to them. And will he ever play? Is it his eye? Is he going to lose his eye? Because, you know, of that swelling. Man, never saw anything like it.
Tony wouldn't play again for 18 months. And so you're sad about losing a teammate and worried about his health. But you're also thinking, this is like our dream season. Things are going so good, but this guy was the middle of our lineup. How are we going to put things together without him?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this was a big blow. Yaz was, he had started hitting home runs, and it was great and all that, but you still need other players, I mean, obviously. Right. Who are they going to get?
I can't imagine how heavily that weighed on manager Dick Williams' mind. So in 67, there are no playoffs. You win the pennant, you go to the World Series, and this was one of the all-time down-to-the-wire great pennant races. Going into the final week of the season, a game and a half separated four teams in the race: Twins, Red Sox, White Sox, and Tigers. And the Red Sox would finish the season with a two-game series at Fenway against the first-place Twins.
The Red Sox and the Twins prepare to go to it in this very big ball game.
Enrico, you guys all knew you had to win both, and you were facing future Hall of Famer Jim Cott.
Yes.
Jim Cott shooting for a possibly unprecedented eighth victory in the month of September.
Well, the thing was that being such a young team, you know, we'd come in, we'd be like little kids jumping around, you know, hey, we're in the big leagues, we're in a pennant race. This is fabulous, you know what I mean? So we were like college kids, rah, rah. We are playing the Twins. They're tough. You know, we know they get some great players. Zoyo Vasalis, former MVP, Killebrew, and on and on, Tony Oliva. But we said, hey, let's go at him. And Jim Cott, I guess he hurt his arm.
And they're going to make the change in this case, as obviously something has come up to bother Jim Cott, and it looks like it's his elbow.
And that gives the Red Sox the life they need. Late in the game, Yaz hits number 44 and seals the win.
Yastrzemski has hit more home runs than any left-handed batter in the history of Boston baseball. And this one came in a clutch situation to give Boston a 6-2 edge here in the seventh.
Which left one game to play. October 1st, 1967. It was a Sunday at Fenway Park. Ken Harrelson, the Hawk, asked Jim Lomborg, who was to be Boston's starting pitcher on Sunday. He asked him the night before, "Hey, Lomborg, where are you going to stay tonight?" And Jim's like, "At my house." Harrelson, who had recently joined the team, said, "No, you're not. You're staying at my hotel room. You had a better record this year on the road when you were staying in hotels." So sure enough, that's where Jim stayed that night. And he wakes up, walks to Fenway Park, and goes out and pitches the final game of the 1967 regular season.
From Fenway Park in Boston, the Minnesota Twins versus the Boston Red Sox.
You know, the Red Sox made a great choice in getting the Hawk, Kenny Harrelson, a great, great guy, team player. He loved people. I mean, and he was so happy to be with the Red Sox. And he did a nice job. He got a lot of big hits for us. Great for the team, in the clubhouse. Man, that was a great move.
It was a rocky start. Twins had a 2-0 lead going into the bottom of the sixth. After making a costly error earlier in the game, now with the bases loaded, Yaz steps up to the plate.
They have been playing all year, and it's boiled down to one game. Yastrzemski base hit out into center field. That'll score two runs. Dalton Jones going to third. Here's Adair coming in to score the tying run.
That was big. That was big. And Yaz did it. He was the man. When Yaz was up there, he came through, and he did again in this game. Wow. You know, that pumped us up. You could imagine. Again, like I say, you know, we were like college kids. We're jumping up and down in the dugout, and, you know, hugging each other and all that.
5-3, ninth inning, two outs.
One more out, and the Red Sox have clinched at least a tie for the pennant.
And what happens, Rico?
Yeah, Rich Rollins. Rich was up, really good hitter. He was very dangerous. So Jim had great stuff. And he threw a pitch inside to Rich. Rich swung and hit not a very high pop-up, and it was heading towards left field. I went back, and I caught it.
There's a little bloop. Petroselli's there. The Red Sox are winning.
And all of a sudden, people started running out on the field. My roomie, Dalton Jones, was at third base. We were hugging each other. Now, I wanted my hat. I wanted something, you know? So
right.
I have my hand on my hat. I think I put dents. It was so hard. I put dents in my head on my fingers. And all of a sudden, somebody comes through and wham, takes it out of my hand, and he's gone.
Oh,
I said, I can't believe this. So, you know, we went into the clubhouse.
And now they'll go to their clubhouse, Pee-wee and Sandy, and stand by to see what happens to the Tigers.
Even though you won, you haven't won the pennant yet. You had to wait for the end of the Angels-Tigers game.
Tigers won the first game. Had to lose the second or else we have a playoff. So we're in there. Every time the Tigers made an out, you know, everybody, yeah. Mr. Yawkey was in there, front office people waiting, listening. And then finally, the Angels went ahead. And then when the last out was made, we went nuts. Of course, everybody's hugging each other, hugging Yaz. I mean, the reporters were in there. And who was in there? One of the reporters, Howard Cosell. And Howard was asking me questions, came up with statistics. You did this. This guy did that. This guy's, Howard, right. We won, you know. Get out of here. Leave me alone. I'm sorry. We were popping the champagne and everything. So,
right.
But what a thrill. I mean, it just was unbelievable.
And what's it like in the street surrounding Fenway?
Well, you go to a supermarket and people recognize, you know, oh, great. You guys are great. Thank you so much for a great season. You know, can I have your autograph? Yeah, of course. I mean, everything's great, you know, when you win. Yeah, in a restaurant, you didn't mind because you just were so happy. And by the way, when we won, Kenmore Square, which is near the ballpark, was people were tooting the horns, stopping the cars, getting out and jumping around and hugging each other. Oh, it was great. It was a long time coming.
Yeah, and, for sure. By the way, every kid dreams of hitting a home run in the World Series. And you hit not one, but two in the same game in the 1967 World Series.
Rico Petroselli's a hitter with two away. Dick Hughes standing, staring down at his catcher. Here's the pitch. That's the ball hit. It can be gone. A home run.
right left field fence on that. That would have been a home run in any park in America. He really pounced on it.
Yeah. Yeah, we hit, I think, I don't know if it's still a record. Me, Yaz, and Reggie Smith hit home runs, I think, in the, was it the same inning?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we had to win that game, but it was a thrill. I mean, just felt comfortable.
The Red Sox pushed the Cardinals to 7 games, but ultimately fell short. Bob Gibson was just absolutely untouchable in Game 7.
You know what you hope for? That Lomborg 2 days rest could put everything together and be strong and have another great game. And then you hope that Gibson was off that day. I don't know. Gibson being off is still a Cy Young Award winner. He was a great pitcher, great athlete. And we knew we were going to have to beat him. We had to stay close. Like Nolan Ryan, same thing. You know, in order to beat him, you can't give up more than 2 runs, 3 runs at the most. So we were hoping that, and no, he was as good as he was the other 2 games and had a great game, struck out a lot of us, and then it was over.
But that season, Rico, if the Red Sox don't win the pennant in 67 and go to the World Series, one of 2 things would have happened. The Red Sox would have left Boston, or Fenway Park would have been torn down.
Yeah, that's right. And we found out in the offseason. We were 66, and I think 65, we averaged 6,000 people a game. But in 67, we started out slow, not that many people. And then it ended up, I think, 1.7 million, which was big in those days. 1.7 million people at Fenway Park, and boom, it saved the franchise from moving. They were starting to make money. And of course, you know, we thought, well, young guys, we're going to do this every year. Okay, what next year?
I'll get you out of here on this. I couldn't have you on without talking about the 1975 World Series. By the way, you hit over 300 in that World Series. The game that everybody remembers, of course, Game 6 at Fenway Park. Red Sox, Reds. Red Sox trying to force a Game 7.
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, Bernie Carbo, of course, without him, we wouldn't have had a Fisk home run. I'm on first base. I think I walked. And Bernie comes up and takes 2 bad swings. And uh-oh. But then he gets a pitch, and he nails it straight away center. I'm at first base. I'm kind of, you know, I'm starting to run, and you can see the trajectory of the ball. This is going to make it into the stands.
Deep center field, way back, way back. We're tied up.
Oh, chills! I get chills now. And what a moment!
And now fast forward a little bit. The score is tied 6-6. Bottom of the 12th. Carlton Fisk walks to the plate.
And Fisk will lead it off, has a single, and has walked twice. And the wind blowing out. There it goes, a long drive. If it stays fair, home run. We will have a 7th game in this 1975 World Series. A lot of body English for Carlton Fisk. Watch him.
How many steps does he take? 1. He waits to see it. Get over.
He knew it. There it is.
Fisk got the opportunity. Pat Darcy, I think it was. And Pat was a sinker ball pitcher. And Fisk was a great, not a bad high ball hitter, but a great low ball hitter. And he got the sinker and bang. It was just a matter of staying fair. You know, stayed fair. Game's over. In the dugout. I almost hit my head on the dugout. I jumped so high. And everybody said, now we ran out there and everybody's on Fisk, you know. Oh, and then going back in the clubhouse. Oh, we got to win tomorrow. I mean, this is it's fate. I mean, you know, we got to win. And we were ahead in the 7th game. Freddie Lynn, 3-run home run. And they started to come back and finally won it on Joe Morgan's base hit to center field. It was a great series. At first, the Big Red Machine, they just thought they were going to roll over us. No respect, as Dangerfield would say.
Right.
No respect. And then by the 7th game and afterwards, they said, hey, this was a hell of a team. They gave us a heck of a fight. Sparky Anderson was always humble when he won. He was a great manager. And it was just great. I was really happy to be in that World Series.
Rico, what an incredible career. 13 years, all spent with the Boston Red Sox, one of the great slugging middle infielders in baseball history, great all-time fielding percentage as well, 2-time All-Star, 2 World Series, and a member of the Boston Red Sox Hall of Fame. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today here on the Lost Ballparks podcast.
Well, thank you so much. It was just a great to talk with you, reminisce a little bit, and baseball is still a great game. We just hope it continues to be that. I look back, I was very fortunate to my dream come true to play in the big leagues, you know, after seeing my first game. And I was fortunate. The Red Sox, thank God they signed me and kept me. So I have nothing but good things to say about them. And it was just an honor to be on your show.
How much fun is that guy? I mean, honestly, after spending some time with him, I want to fly to Boston and watch a game with him at Fenway Park and just talk about Red Sox history. And he was there for some of the biggest moments in that franchise's history. Every once in a while, MLB Network will televise an old World Series game. And if you ever get a chance to watch one of the ones from 67 or 75, even now, all these years later, you don't even have to be a Red Sox or a Reds fan or a Cardinals fan. You get chills watching those games. Want to thank our producers, Briggs Buckingham, Maddie Zavlakis, Xavier Guerra, Michael Ortman, and Mike Dunn. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. And I look forward to spending some more time with you next Wednesday on the Lost Ballparks podcast.